Jeffrey McGiven is to thousands of people across the globe the voice of Ford Prefect in Douglas Adams' cult hit radio series, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
He will enter our story in 35 seconds and say,
"I've just discovered a new wrinkle."
I caught up with him as he tours with a new live stage version of the radio show, and I gave him a ring in his Manchester Jury's Inn hotel room.
Let me just get into a comfortable position in this hideous hotel room. Of which we've seen. I've just discovered a new wrinkle. If ever you're touring around, and let me just get this. Hang on. If ever you're touring around and you go to a Jury's Inn, hang on.
Stick your finger down his throat.
Ask them if they're putting you in a disabled room with disabled facilities in the bathroom. Because you know what I've just found out? I was going to have a nice hot bath before being interviewed by you, and you can't get hot water in a room with disabled facilities.
Really?
Yeah, because somebody might have an accident. They might scald themselves. So without asking you, they put you in a room where you can't get a decent hot bath, which is one of the pleasures of touring, I can tell you.
And I've just sat through an advert for Jury's Inn before getting put through to you.
Of course you have, yes, of course. No, yes, they're very strange. They kind of look like a four-star hotel, and they're not. No room service and tepid water in rooms with these great huge handles, like in a disabled loo, everywhere, so you can pull yourself around, which is a perfectly good thing. But it seems odd to me that you can't get a hot bath. Anyway, I digress. These are the pleasures and pains of touring. You start to become obsessed with minutiae and the fact that the good ones always anticipate what you might need. So, you know, there are always tissues in the good ones, and there is some kind, you can get a meal. If you're in the provinces and you're touring around, we finish anywhere between 10 and 10:30, and we always have to factor in about 15 minutes for the autographs afterwards. And then you're touching on closing time, and also everywhere closes, so you can't get a meal. And very few actors like eating before a show because it kind of slows you down. So it's just a series of frustrations, apart from the shows, which are fabulous.
So has it been fun touring so far, apart from the hotel nightmares?
Well, apart from that and the coach travel, which I could do without, don't get me started on the design problems of Mercedes coaches. But basically, if you tilt the seat back, it should be comfortable, and you shouldn't slide off the seat beneath the seat in front of you, it seems to me. Seems a fairly basic thing. So apart from the back trouble caused by the seats in the coach and the incredibly varied standard of supposedly same standard hotels, we will not mention Reading, which was no names, no patrol, because, you know, these corporate lawyers are sharks. But there was a hotel in Reading which was one step above a bail hostel. In fact, the drunk teenagers outside during the day and night seem to have been the previous occupants. All that is a bit of a pain to me since I am now advancing in years and I like, you know, my routine. So the packing and the unpacking and all the ancillary stuff I could do without. But when we get on stage and we've got a fantastic crew who travel through the night in a crew bus, you know, and kind of sleep in bunks and then do the get-in in various theatres, which are phenomenally badly designed, many of them, especially the new ones. With yesterday, for example, they had to winch everything in because there was no ramp because of the fact that it was below street level, which is a huge amount of work, and carry great, huge travelling cases, you know, just extraordinary. I mean, as soon as we get to the theatre and do our sound check at 6:15 and then get ready for the show and then do the show. I mean, last night at the Opera House in Manchester, we're here for three nights, and it was phenomenal. No, it's going great. We had we're having full houses and near full houses, enthusiasm, cheering crowd, standing up, you know, waving towels, twirling towels above their heads, and love it, you know, and not in every single case, but most nights they get the jokes, and they get the jokes that we can't do, if you know what I mean. We have a moment where Slarty Bartfast says to Arthur, when he's explaining how he's travelled through time, and he's saying, "Oh, well, you know, you haven't done that yet, or you have in the past and you don't remember it." because you haven't travelled to the right place to realise that you've done something in the past or in the future. And it's very complicated. And he just says, that, I mean, you've missed whole chapters of your life. And there's a huge, the first night that line went through, which I hadn't really noticed, there was a huge laugh from the audience at the recognition that the adaptation has had to fill it so much out in order to get a second act that makes some kind of sense, that they just roared at the idea that, you know, we were missing huge amounts out. Very good stuff. And it's wonderful to get big, big woofing laughs back at favourite lines and themes. So it's been a joy.
Why do you think The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy has such appeal and has, you know, such massive appeal that people are flocking all over the country to see you all back together again?
I think Douglas Adams was a genius. I mean, I know he wrote other stuff, but the masterwork is Hitchhiker. And it's the fact that it's very, very trivial in that it's an everyman. We were saying last night, it's like Candide or something. It's a picaresque novel as our innocent hero goes on his travels. And it's also, it's trivial because he's always in search of a decent cup of tea. And it's also huge because it puts all his trivial concerns and all our trivial concerns into the context of being a tiny, unregarded planet at the unfashionable western arm, you know, what is it, the unfashionable end of the spiral arm of the galaxy. I can't remember the exact phrase. He has such breadth of vision of how extraordinary it is that we live in this vast universe with all the possibilities that it contains, and yet basically it's about having a nice bath and a cup of tea.
Which
I have demonstrated this morning by the fact that I can't get a hot bath in the hotel.
How did you first meet Douglas Adams?
I didn't. Of the first time I saw Douglas Adams, I met him later, but in my first week at Cambridge in 1972, he was the year above me, I think. I'd gone with a load of other people. The Cambridge Union wanted to recruit people to pay their sub and join. And they gave you a tour of the union during an evening, showed you all the facilities, which were not lavish. And also there was a debate going on with everybody in, you know, black and white tie and being very undergraduate-y and having some comic debate. And we were in the gallery, and in walked, the next speaker was announced, and I didn't catch the name. And this incredibly tall man with this huge nose came walking in very casual clothes. I mean, I remember them as pajamas, but it was more like a kind of pajama bottoms and a t-shirt. But it was very casual, and he was carrying and eating from a bowl of cereal. He walked into the Cambridge Union and was making his speech as he walked in through the big doors, eating a bowl of cereal, and got big laughs and was very funny. And then they moved us on, you know, the tour had to go on. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. And then I met him through doing Smokers and getting into Footlights. And he wanted to be a performer in Footlights, but he really couldn't play anything but Douglas Adams. And to be a review performer, you've got to be able to play the shopkeeper and the Prime Minister. You know, you've got to be able to or indeed the Prime Minister's wife. You've got to cover the waterfront. And Douglas was always Douglas. He was in a review troupe, Adam Smith Adams. Anyway, he wrote for this review, which went to the West End and was murdered by the critics, called Chocks. And I got tons of laughs doing his monologue called Easy Terms about a very liberal kindergarten where, the kids got away with murder and the teacher was frightened of them. And knew him from then on.
And was there sort of any of the beginnings of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and any of his writing while you were...
No, it was... I mean, somebody commented, either in a tweet or a review, that the Vogon scene at the beginning of the second act is a very Douglas large cast sketch. You know, it's very much on his lines. I did one for the virtual 60th. A few of us did his one about railway engineer, railway signals, and it's a wonderful conceit if somebody organised the railways on philosophical principles, and it had wonderful stuff. And so, no, there was no hint. I mean, I don't think there was any hint for Douglas. He just came up you know, the famous story of him lying on his back on a Greek island, I think, wasn't it? I mean, he was making his way around Europe, doing the old Eurail thing, you know, the Euro pass and all the rest of it, and was lying on his back and just came up, the title popped into his head as he was looking at the stars on this lovely, balmy Greek evening, night, and thought, ah, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And then, of course, was always under the cosh to produce it. But it had all been boiling. And to go back to your question about why does it appeal, I think it's partly, it's two things. I've noticed in the fans who come back and talk to us is, A, it's phenomenal. I mean, the ideas are so funny. I mean, the one of the great set pieces in the show is Stephen Moore, who isn't, you know, he's there in voice. He's the voice of Marvin, and he's the voice of the sperm whale, which is one of the great arias of comic writing, where a whale is conjured into existence by the infinite improbability drive 300 miles above the planet of what turns out to be Magrathea. And his monologue of coming into existence, naming things, you know, all very kind of philosophical ideas, the naming of things. And, of course, he has a touching. It's very Douglas to be very, very intelligent and very emotional at the same time, to bring it down to a very human emotion, which is when the whale finally decides what this big round, I'll call it ground.
That's it, ground!
As he's heading towards what he's decided to call the ground, he wonders pathetically,
I wonder if it'll be friendly with him.
Just before he hits it at terminal velocity.
I mean, every time I listen to The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, my dad bought it for me on cassette a number of years ago.
That ages you.
Yes, which I've managed to wear out. But just quite how perfect all the lines are and how much work went into each of them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the other part. There is the fact of Douglas's brain. And he did, because the famous line about he loved deadlines, he loved the sound of them whizzing past. He poured his brain into the script. You know, he wasn't a careful... I mean, he was very careful as a prose writer, but he couldn't say, oh, I'll keep that for some other project, you know. He needed to hit the deadline and produce that episode, and then later the books. So, it all came tumbling out. But the other reason, it's the fact that Jeffrey Perkins, Simon Brett did the pilot, and then the late Jeffrey Perkins did the series. And it was a phenomenally difficult thing because it was the days of splicing tape. And he was at the radiophonic workshop up at Maida Vale, the ex-ice rink, Maida Vale Studios, where this tiny little place called the Radiophonic Workshop, who did all the Doctor Who stuff and all the rest of it, and strange experimental stuff for the third program, as it was. They, you know, did the explosion of the world.
Energize the demolition beams.
When you listen to it, especially on modern equipment, you know, it's phenomenal what they did. And the fact that he also cast it so perfectly. So, you know, I mean, Toby Longworth is great as Slarty Bartfast, but he is in the tradition of Richard Vernon, who's one of the most wonderful actors who ever lived and was a wonderful kind of English character actor with a really dry delivery and an ease of delivery. And he cast brilliantly. Deep Thought was Valentine Dial, who back in The Mists of Time was the Man in Black. And just phenomenal. Richard Goulden, who was the original mole in Toad of Toad Hall stage thing, a wonderful little moly guy. I mean, he just cast it so brilliantly. And they stand up, and people love that all those radio things.
And on the casting, I mean, how did you come to get your role as full prefect? Were you approached?
It was very simple. I don't even remember auditioning. I mean, Simon Jones was definitely, Arthur Dent was written with him in mind. But my dad said when he read the description of Ford in the first book and how he would talk and how he would take things in, he said, well, that's you when you were 18, you know. I mean, I just got a call to say, would you like to do this pilot? And I'd known Douglas. I didn't know Simon Brett. And up I turned. But Douglas did say to somebody once, well, you know, Jeffrey can talk for half an hour on a new pair of shoes and kind of, you know, the wonder of a pair of shoes. That's very much kind of, you know, I do find life like a jury's in, you know, it's a, you know, there are strange kind of quirks. And turned up and was quite nervous because it was a very early job for me, 77, when we did the pilot. I mean, I'd been about 2 years in the business and I'd done a few weekend things, but not that much. I was doing theatre for about 5 years in the late 70s. And it was just a fit, you know. Though I do sound quite nervous. When I first come on, I say, "Hello, Arthur," and I do it. I sound like a boy treble because I was quite nervous.
Hello, Arthur.
Four. Hello, Arthur. And then the Vogons blew the world up, so it was fine, yeah. Off we went.
Do you see Ford, therefore, I mean, as your character, that the character embodies you?
Well, no, that would be too much. I mean, Ford's an interesting character in that Zaphod's a very kind of dominating, you know, he's a president, he's a crook. Arthur's our hero, you know, who has to have things explained to him. He's never seen any of this before, so he's like our picaresque hero. Who, and I'm basically what they used to call Ciccheroni. They used to have them in Florence, and it's based on the idea of, I'm getting in deep waters here, but Dante's Inferno, there is a guide to hell and the various stages of hell. And that's what Ford is. Ford is Arthur's guide through all this. And it's a very necessary thing. If you're going to go into strange worlds, you need some kind of guide, somebody to make sense of it for you, so you start to pick up what's going on.
What the hell is it?
It's a fleet of flying saucers. What do you think it is? Quick, you've got to get hold of this rock.
What do you mean, flying saucers?
It's always felt very easy and felt quite kind of natural. And I think we've all had this sensation of feeling that we are, you know, sometimes you look around and you think, well, I feel like an alien observing this. So I've always kind of plugged into that idea. And the fact that Ford is fairly louche. I mean, he basically likes drinking and dancing with girls and hanging out in the latest spot. And then he files a report and off he goes. I never get the sense that Ford's left got anybody back home. He's very much a kind of traveller.
Was there a feeling when you were recording the original series that you were making something that was special?
I think we knew it was good, yeah. And it was so enjoyable to do. And it was very, sometimes got very hairy when we recorded it in a lovely place called the Paris Studio, which for decades in Lower Regent Street had been where they recorded all the great shows, you know, Round the Horn, all that stuff, Beyond Our Ken, Itmar, right through the war it carried on. It was a fantastic Art Deco place with lovely plush red seats, all, of course, empty because we were recording in stereo. There is a story. It's a true story that Douglas hadn't finished the script. And we recorded 10 till 6, and we had to finish at 6. There was no money to go over, a minute over. And at 5:45, we hadn't seen the last scene. And indeed, he hadn't finished it, because there was a little room around the corner along the corridor, which was called the narration suite, which was basically where, in the old days, they would hand over from Broadcasting House, where a man in a dinner jacket would hand over to another man at the Paris studio in the narration suite, also probably in a dinner jacket, who would say, yes, and you join us here at the Paris studio for Kenneth Horne, and then he would do the intro, and off the show would go with a green light. And Douglas was in there with a big old Olympia typewriter with loads and loads of very, very thin, crinkly, crackly onion skin paper with carbons, this is so long ago, carbons in between, typing out enough, the final bit of the scene. And when he finished, we were each handed a thin, crackly, noisy piece of paper, a couple of pieces of paper, and we had to sight read it on mic, and we just finished as the second hand hit 6. It was hairy and immense fun, but I have to say, we had no idea of, none of us had any idea of the reaction it would be. It was put out on a Tuesday night at 10:30. They basically said to Simon Brett, and then he left and Jeff Perkins took over, "Well, go ahead then. You think it's funny. That's good enough for us, but we don't get it." They put it out late, and it got an audience immediately, and it was very interesting over the next kind of 6 months, a year, and then we did another series. And we could you could see references to it. Suddenly there'd be a reference in the Sunday newspaper, The Observer or somewhere. And then you'd hear somebody quote a line. And then you'd see, it was phenomenal to see how a cult grows. And of course in those days, it was pre-internet. It was pure word of mouth. And then we realized, within about, you know, a year, 2 years, boy, people love this.
What was it like returning to the series for the tertiary phase in 2003? Of course, this time, sadly, without Douglas Adams.
Well, that's right. And, of course, crucially, Peter Jones was no more. And Peter Jones, I mean, we have wonderful guest books on this. I mean, we've got John Challis, who at times sounds uncannily like Simon Jones, which is very odd. And we had John Culshaw do it, who's doing... Tonight and Tomorrow here in Manchester.
Hey, I'm sure he can make himself sound like Peter Jones.
He does Peter Jones in the first half, and then he does a kind of, and then he does a bit of Tom Baker, and then he does who's this guy, Patrick Moore. But something about, you know, then we had the wonderful Bill Franklin, who was the shush you know who guy, and phenomenally cool, I think Australian originally. But so we've been so lucky in people who've turned up and just been fab. You know, Jonathan Pryce has come in and done a lot. He ended up being the evil Zani Whoop, who was like the evil Murdochian figure at the center of everything, really, which we don't have in this adaptation because, you know, Dirk Maggs, who's done a fabulous job adapting it and producing the whole thing and is the drummer in the band as well, he's had to leave stuff out. But coming back together, it was extraordinary. We were all gathered together, and within 15 minutes, it was as if it was 1978. You know, it was just we suddenly fell into, because in any group you have like roles. You know, you kind of you settle into your kind. It's like people settling into armchairs, and within minutes we were all. It was all as if no time had gone by at all. It was great, and then new people came in. People like Joanna Lumley and Rula Lenska my memory for names is terrible, but I mean just wonderful new people for new characters turning up. It was great. And this reunion has been fantastic.
And what's Dirk Maggs like as a director compared to Geoffrey Perkins?
Well, they're different. Basically, any good producer just wants to get it right. You know, and it's not so much about telling people, because, you know, I mean, Dirk said when he took over, he said, you know these characters better than I do. My job is really just to record what you're doing. And if I think it needs to be fed up a bit because we're maybe dragging on something, then that's what I'll do. It's basic stuff that you're always told, you know. I mean, the idea that if you're doing comedy, you should treat it like a game of tennis or badminton. And you should pick up your cues. Don't leave a pause. Ping in your line. And like flicking a badminton shuttlecock up, flick it back to them and flick it back to them so that when you finally, somebody says something to somebody and they pause, then the whole audience notices the pause because it's like a piece of music with a sudden pause in the middle of it. And then you lean forward to think what's going to happen next. And that's really the art of directing.
It sounds like you're relishing the sort of the directness to the audience that you didn't get when you were originally performing it to the microphones in the
right.
Studio.
Yes. No, that's really how this came about, is because when we did a reading for charity, it was at the Royal Geographical Society, and Steven Pinker gave a lecture, and then we as a kind of post-lecture, you know, sorbet, did a kind of truncated 40 minutes, I don't know how long it was, of Hitchhiker. We'd never done it before an audience. And that was okay, but it was it wasn't a fan audience. You know, there were some fans there, people who liked it, but it was a very kind of quite scientific audience. But that was interesting and quite enjoyable. And then we did it at Hitchcom, at the Royal Festival Hall. And there were lots of fans there, and the response blew your socks off, really. Because lines that we had done into silence, and presumably had got laughs, you know, all around Britain and all around the world when they were eventually heard, we had no awareness of. And then when we're doing you know, particularly the kind of opening book scenes, it was just coming back in waves of delighted laughter. And that's when people started to say, well, that's really enjoyable. And also, people love being part of the experience.
Owen Colfer, of course, has written And Another Thing a couple of years ago. If there was any chance, would you, you know, like to play Ford again for a dramatisation of Owen Colfer's novel?
Never say never. You know, it's that's up in the air. But, I mean, there is talk, because the venues have seen the enthusiasm and the audiences, other venues are interested in it. So, you know, it seems very likely that we will, you know, in some form do this again. It seems, you know, that the talk is going on. Nothing's decided. But, no, I'm happy doing it. I mean, I have my own reservation. For reasons we don't need to go into, I didn't do the telly. I was doing a play called The Dresser, which became a film with Albert Finney and Tom Courtney. And I was in the original stage production way back when they were about to do the TV. And I had a contract for a year in the West End. And they did the dramatization, and for whatever reason, I'm not dissing it, but it seems to me that, like P.G. Woodhouse and Jane Austen, Hitchhiker doesn't work as a drama. And I've seen bits of the film. I haven't seen the whole film. But it's quite hard to watch because I know it so well, you know, and I'm thinking, no, I'm not sure about that, and I'm not sure about that. And I didn't like the Marvin. I've always thought the Marvin should be like a cyborg, a kind of, you know, like Blade Runner kind of robot, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Seems to me you give the actor a lot more to do, and Stephen Moore should have done it, because he's such a fine actor, and he would have been so funny just as a kind of metalized man, because that gives it more humanity. Though our marionette is fantastic, operated by Tom Mack. I mean, superb. He's the star of the show. We all acknowledge that Marvin is the star of the show. He gets the biggest entrance round and the biggest laughs and the standing ovation. And we beat him up backstage and then repair the metal, you know. But it seems to me that there is a basic problem with dramatizing. You see, in this, we have the book on a podium and he's a man sitting in an armchair, you know, reading the book. That's fine. It acknowledges that the book is an entity, a voice, and an integral, crucial part of the drama. Mm-hmm. It's always seemed to me that in adaptations of P.G. Woodhouse and Jane Austen, if you cannot forefront the authorial voice, you can't, unless you have Jane Austen walking around on camera, you know, introducing you to people, which you can't do, it would be so artificial. If it's just the story, you've lost three quarters of the interest of the work. Similarly with Hitchhiker, the voice is so important that the story on its own isn't as interesting as it is. It's to the power of 10 more interesting when you have the book as the integral part of the drama. And no dramatization can get around that. You can do a voiceover, but voiceovers never quite work for me, because they're not as strong a character as the people you're looking at. It's a visual medium. And the book, Douglas's voice and Douglas's voices he uses in all the wonderful stuff. You know, I mean, the extraordinary thing, funny, every night is the Babel fish and it's proof of the non-existence of God. It's just one of the great, it's just a pleasure to listen to. Mm. And if you're watching a drama of dramatization, you don't get that.
Now, turning away from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy just for a moment, I mean, you've worked on a range of hugely successful shows, from Blackadder to Peep Show, and a vast array of different people. Has there been a favourite moment in your career, or is that still Hitchhiker's Guide?
Well, Hitchhikers is a huge, it's always the first line. And I always say I was the original Ford Prefect, you know, in the radio series. So it's a huge part of my life. But it's actually the last couple of years, I've started to get parts on television and been kind of comfortable enough in front of the camera to do what I want to do. I'm in a thing at the moment, which is on Thursdays on BBC Three, called Dead Boss, written by Sharon Horgan and Holly Walsh, and in which Sharon Horgan stars, and Jennifer Saunders plays the prison governor, about a woman who's framed for a murder at her work. And I'm her useless solicitor, Tony Norman. And I turn private eye to try and help prove that she's innocent. And that was a really kind of interesting and tough. It was the first time through, and it's getting a very good response, and I've got a really good part in it. And I've had a few things. I had a really good year this year. It started off, you know you have work at the beginning of the year, which was for an online kind of ad thing, but it was quite a funny series of sketches about a guy organising a competition for a chocolate bar. But the point was, it was done by very funny kind of director and writers. And so this period has been really good. And just waiting to see if Dead Boss goes to BBC One or Two, and more crucially, gets a second series. Because I'd love to carry on playing him, because he's wonderfully useless and craven and self-serving, but also quite endearing. And comes out with, he gets trapped in the storeroom when he's trying to scope out her work, you know, her offices, where she worked, where she was framed. And he gets locked in a storeroom for the weekend. And he ends up, and he's in a stationery cupboard. So he eats the blue tack and says, day three, very, very thirsty. I've finished the last of the blue tack.
I've finished the last of the blue tack. It's actually not that disgusting if you imagine it as a spring roll.
Not bad. I'm trying to think what he compares it to. It's not so bad if you imagine it. And I've completely forgotten the line, which probably happened on the day.
Things aren't looking good.
But he's just a very kind of craven, stupid guy. He ends up sleeping in a large box on the floor. And it's cast, wonderful cast of Emma Pearson. So that's been my highlight of the last year or so. And Little Dorrit was good. I enjoyed doing Little Dorrit. But this Dead Boss, I think, is good. It's had very positive and a couple of equivocal ones, but apparently it's getting a very good response, and hopefully it'll go again.
I caught the first two, and I was very impressed, so I need to catch up with the rest of them very soon before they go off the iPlayer.
Yeah, the third and fourth, I think, the third and fourth, it kind of kicks on. And it started so many good characters off. You know, the prison wardens and it builds and it builds. Her funny little cellmate, the arsonist, played by, is it Bryony Hanna? I mean, very, very funny. And I'm hoping that goes again. Because, you know, I have done lots of stuff, but it's amazing how often. I was in a thing called Lab Rats, which I loved doing, which was based on Chris Addison's radio shows. And he and Carl Cooper wrote Lab Rats, but for one reason or another, it didn't go again, which was a real shame. I played the most outrageous Professor John Mycroft, who'd, as I put it, had woken up, had kept waking up one summer and was very full of ideas and bright, and 20 years later won a Nobel Prize because he just had a few good ideas one summer. And was a monstrous egotist, and was such a pleasure to play because he was completely amoral, and it was a joy. And I had a goatee beard, which I always enjoy.
Now, of course, you're coming here to York on Thursday, and I believe you grew up here in York.
I did. I moved to York when I was nearly four from Clapham Junction in London. I was a little cockney. And I was basically, I went to St. George's Primary School, which I thought, in 1970 and frozen to death, I came back to work at the York Theatre Royal after university and started to do, I did an ill-fated BBC job that turned into nothing. And then I went into rep and I ended up at York Theatre Royal. By this time, my family had moved to Jersey, but I was playing in York Theatre Royal, where I first saw Great Expectations when I was about 10. And was so terrified by Mr. Murdstone, I think that's the right character, that I thought, blimey, I'd like to play him when I'm about 40. And I was back in York, and I thought St. George's Primary School was over where the old cattle market used to be, by the city walls, which we're so used to in York. You know, we're going, oh yeah, the Roman walls, you know, the medieval walls. And it is extraordinary, you know, that they're still there. And you went through the Roman wall. So I went for a Proustian walk to see my old Catholic primary school as a much lapsed Catholic soon after. I left there, but I was an altar boy and everything. So I saw the church And I, you know, beating heart, went round the corner to look on my old school and hopefully, you know, small children playing and the whole bit. And I walked around the corner and all I saw in the windows of the school was Carpet Warehouse, big bargains, come in now. No Proustian moment for me. And then I went to Archbishop Holgate's Grammar School. And that's where I first acted. I did, you know, school plays.
Of course, you're coming back again to the Grand Opera House this Thursday to perform Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy here.
Yes, the Grand Opera House, which, I mean, it's not recent, but the Grand Opera House wasn't the Grand Opera House when I was growing up.
And finally, Ford Prefect chose his name because it was common and he thought he'd fit in. What name do you think Ford would have now?
Oh, well, that's an interesting one. Well, he couldn't, yes. I mean, it has to be one of these bizarre made-up names. If it was still a car name, I mean, Kia Picanto. Is there such a thing?
It'll give the character
a female. I think that would be Ford's female sidekick. You know, kind of teenage rebellious, a bit like Sam Bayar in as Random in this, the kind of goth, kind of, you know, who totally disrespects him. Kia Picanto. Kia Picanta. You know, make it feminine. I'm trying to think of what else. Or Rolodex. Rolodex or something like that.
Well,
yeah, it's hard to pick out something that would not jar. You see, there's, you know, the genius of Douglas. He just picked the perfect thing.
Well, Geoff McGiven, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for speaking to me today. I can't wait to see the show on Thursday.
Well, come round and say hello.
I'd love to. And for our listeners, cheers. Of course, it's this Thursday at the Grand Opera House here in York. Thank you so much for talking to me.
My absolute pleasure.